This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9, with myself, Fiona, and our special guest host, Misha Ketchell.
Yes. So we're about to speak to Peter Grester, who many Australians might know. He sort of became prominent in Australia, must be 7 or 8 years ago now, maybe even 10 years ago, when he was incarcerated in Egypt. And there was an international campaign to get him released. He was incarcerated as a journalist just for doing his job. I think everybody from Barack Obama to, you know, world leaders all over the world were involved in the campaign that eventually saw his release. Since he's been back in Australia, he's actually been a leading voice for journalists and journalism. He's become a journalism professor and a campaigner on behalf of the importance of public interest journalism and the importance of a healthy media ecosystem. And we're actually very keen to talk to him about the decision by Facebook, by Meta, Facebook's parent company, to pull out of news, but also more generally about the role of journalism in society and sort of its impact on public policy. So he's actually a terrific guest for us to have, so I'm very pleased.
We are very pleased. Welcome, Peter, to the program.
It's fantastic to be here. Thank you for having me.
And now, you wrote a piece in The Conversation recently, of course, about how Meta's refusal to pay for news will how it will affect Australian journalism and democracy. Let's maybe start with talking about media freedom and what that means.
That's a very big question. How long have we got? Look,
we've got a while.
look, I think, you know, we think of the media as the fourth estate, and that's the classic model of democracy, alongside the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. In other words, it's one of the key pillars of the way that a democracy actually works. Now, the media is often dysfunctional. It's not particularly edifying. It's a human construct, so it often gets things wrong. But it is an essential part of the way that the system actually operates. It holds those other three pillars of government to account. It does so on behalf of the public. But it can only do that if it has the freedom to operate. And philosophers often talk in terms of both positive freedom and negative freedom. There's the negative freedom is the way we think of when we typically think of when we speak of media freedom. That's freedom from overbearing legislation, freedom from interference by government. But there is that positive freedom, and I think this is where Meta's decision comes into play here. And that's the freedom to. In other words, you've got to have not just be clear of the restrictions, legal restrictions, but you've also got to have the capacity and the financial wherewithal to be able to do the kind of investigations that we actually need. And so when you end up with a media that is financially constrained, then you end up with a media that isn't as free as it needs to be.
So, Peter, Meta's decision to withdraw from news, I think many people would say, look, that's a commercial decision. A company can make a decision. It can decide what products it should be in, it shouldn't be in. You know, do you think it would be an appropriate response for the government to designate Meta and try to force Meta to negotiate with media companies now that they've made that decision?
Look, yes and no. So it's true that Meta has to some extent benefited from the media. I think it has made that commercial decision, though, that it's just not worth its while. And it's hard to criticise Meta for behaving as you'd expect any profit-making enterprise to behave. But I also think that by forcing Meta to negotiate with news organisations, it forces it does a couple of things. It forces news organisations to provide a product that Meta and Google as well, who is a part of the other big behemoth, who's a part of the News Media Bargaining Code. It forces news organisations to produce content that suits those platforms, those algorithms. In other words, content that people like to share on Facebook. And that's not always the same as good journalism. It tends to prioritise clickbait. And I just don't think that's a good way for journalists to go about their business, to have one eye on the kind of stuff that that Google and Meta are interested in. It also forces us to treat news as a commodity in the same way that we think that we trade with soap or hamburgers or whatever. And the fact is that news isn't like that. News has a public service role. We talk about public interest journalism, and that means journalism that serves the public. But the trouble is that's not always the same as stuff that's financially viable. And finally, I think that this absolves us of having a really difficult but important conversation around the role that, as I said, that journalism plays in our democracy, in the way that if it's meant to serve the public interest, then somewhere along the line, the public is ultimately going to have to pay for it.
To some extent, it feels to me like we need to rip the Band-Aid off, because we're not going to be able to prevent Facebook from making... I don't know. Do you feel that the government has any options to force Facebook to continue to pay for this, to pay for Australian content?
That's the way the law works. The law says that the government can fine, or the ACCC can fine Meta and fine it pretty substantially. Certainly far more than it's been paying now. But Meta also has some options up its sleeve. It can simply stop accessing news as it did during the negotiation phase. That was pretty disastrous for Meta, but it did that, and I suppose it could do it again, or it could pull out of Australia altogether, as it's also threatened to do.
So
ultimately, Australia's a pretty small market for Facebook, so I don't think we've got huge amounts of leverage.
Yeah. So Peter, just going back a little bit, because you raised an interesting question there, which is that if you're producing content for Meta or for Google, for that matter, because of the way the algorithms operate, certain things are incentivized, and the values of what's incentivized aren't the same as the values of news. And I think I would argue that journalism has been transformed or changed, certainly sometimes in ways that aren't good ways, by this desire to chase clicks and feed the algorithm what the algorithm wants. And that then raises another interesting question, which was, I was saying before, I remember my time when I was at the ABC in around about 2010, and we were chasing audiences by putting a lot of content on Facebook for free. Do you think it was a mistake for the media to sort of start working with these platforms to begin with and accepting sort of the paradigm of the way that they worked?
At the time, I understand why news organisations did it. You know, the digital revolution destroyed the old business models. That's a bit of a cliche, but it clearly happened. And, you know, in a desperate bid to stay alive and stay relevant, news organisations felt that they had no choice but to deal with Meta and Facebook, or Meta and Google, and produce content that was going to be, that was going to serve the digital world and those algorithms. But I don't think in retrospect that it was healthy. I mean, it's pretty clear. All of the news organizations that design themselves for the new digital environment have started to fall away. Organizations like Vice a whole host of them have disappeared from view. And it seems pretty clear that ultimately if any news organization that has tried to make news a commercial product has simply collapsed, and we haven't found a way to do that in a digital environment. I don't know if you say it was a mistake. I just don't see how else they could have operated, but I think it's forced us into this position where we really need to reconceive the way that news works in our society.
But we're also in a position where Facebook can say, I think, you know, with a degree of accuracy, that news is not a big part of their commercial model, and they can get along quite happily without it. Now, that's a commercial decision, but that then doesn't go to the question of the role of public interest journalism or the role of journalism in terms of things like social cohesion, keeping people informed, the actual public interest needs for journalism. So I want to ask you, just putting all this stuff with Meta to one side, because I know you're very interested in sort of a healthy journalism ecosystem more generally. What are the things that you think the government can be doing and should be doing to ensure that journalism, the sort of journalism that we need, prospers in Australia?
So So I think we need to, as I said, we need to somehow figure out a way of decoupling news production from commercial or political pressure. In the pre-digital world, the most news organizations, newspapers in particular, made what became known in the industry as the rivers of gold from classified advertising. But the key there was the classified ads. People who posted an ad to sell a car or rent an apartment weren't at all bothered by what was on the front pages. And so the editors could quite safely produce journalism for the public good, for sound editorial reasons, without having to worry about it affecting their bottom line. And we need to figure out a way of achieving that kind of outcome again. Now, I happen to think that a model along the lines of the BBC's licence fee is a good way to go. For those of you who don't know, everyone in the UK who owns a television pays a licence, and that money goes directly to the BBC. It's collected by an independent authority, doesn't go anywhere near government. Now, I'm not suggesting that we do that precisely here in Australia, but conceptually, what the licence fee does is, well, it's premised on a general understanding by the public that the public needs to pay for a public broadcaster, that it needs to be ring-fenced from commercial or political pressure, that it needs to be transparent and tied to the way that people consume it. And if we convert that to our modern environment and say, okay, everybody can gets their news and information through their digital devices now, if we say charge a levy on data that appears at the bottom of everyone's data plan, that money is collected by an independent authority and is distributed to all news organisations across the board that achieve a certain level of readership or a certain number of audiences and readers, and provided they subscribe to an editorial code of conduct and provide journalism in areas that are now disappearing, then I think you've got a model that might actually work. It's politically difficult because news is on the nose. A lot of people don't distrust journalism, distrust news. A lot of people are tuning out of it because of the flood of what appears to be unrelenting bad news lately. But if we can't find a way of paying for this kind of journalism, then it'll disappear. And if it disappears, our democracy collectively is going to be a hell of a lot worse off.
You certainly bring Adele Ferguson to this point in your article. I mean, Adele Ferguson is a good friend of this program, and we have had her on the show many times. And I guess it's just whether or not the public understands that the work of someone like Adele Ferguson in bringing forward and exposing bad behaviour of the banks and some of the other incredible investigative journalism that has come out of the Fairfax organisation, Nine, and of course numbers of other organisations, that brought forth the Banking Royal Commission, which therefore all Australians benefit from. So, I mean, do you think that perhaps there's not a great enough association with that people understand that this is what public interest journalism is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. All of the surveys, there's the Edelman Trust Barometer, which is an annual survey. It's a global survey of trust in institutions. And in Australia, it shows that more than half of Australians distrust the media, distrust journalism. I think part of the problem is the way that journalists generally have allowed their ethics to slip, but it's also because journalism sits alongside all of the other all sorts of other content, and it's very difficult to know what to trust if you can't distinguish between them. News and information all looks pretty much the same online. And we haven't been able to make a strong case for the role of that kind of journalism. As you said, Adele spent years on her investigation into the banking system. I'd wager that most Australians wouldn't have read her work, but as you said, every Australian benefited from it. Now, if you're doing a straight cost-benefit analysis, the simple fact is that the Sydney Morning Herald is highly unlikely to have recovered through advertising and through subscriptions, enough revenue to pay for Adele from her stories.
Yeah. Peter, we're just going to take a short break just for 30 seconds or so, and we'll be back to continue the conversation and you're on Saturday Magazine. It's Misha Ketchell interviewing Peter Grist. Peter, you were just making that point a moment ago about the actual cost of producing the journalism and the fact that producing high-quality public interest journalism doesn't always deliver a commercial return. If we're going to say that public journalism is a good that we want to pursue in society and we want government to support that, how do you think a government can define what is public interest journalism so that therefore it can fund it?
I think the word is journalism more than public interest. Deciding what's public interest and not public interest starts to land you in very difficult territory. Is sports news public interest journalism or not? Is entertainment news public interest journalism? I think it's far more important for us to focus on what is journalism, period. And that's content that is produced to an ethical and professional standard, that's accountable to that standard. I don't think it's particularly controversial. I think that any it's there in pretty much every news organization's code of conduct. It's the Media Entertainment Arts Alliance, the Journalist Union has a journalist code of ethics, and that's all. They're all pretty similar. They contain much the same kind of principles. I think accountability to a code is enough to say that that's journalism. If we start ring-fencing public interest journalism as opposed to other forms of journalism, then I think we get ourselves into all sorts of difficult knots. The issue, though, is to, as you said, is not just about the journalism itself, but it's to find a way that we can pay for it, so we can let journalists produce content that might be in the public good, but not necessarily commercially viable.
I guess the key problem there, though, is that you've got journalism that is competing in an attention economy in a digital environment with people who are producing content who don't subscribe to those sorts of codes of conduct you're talking about, like, for example, Meta. I mean, Meta can do anything in terms of the way it generates its content to maintain people's attention. So in that sort of ecosystem, how do you actually ensure that there is a model that's going to support the production of the journalism that actually complies by the sorts of standards you're talking about?
Well, this actually cuts to the core of what my organisation, the Alliance for Journalist Freedom, is arguing for. We think that we need a professional association for journalism, the same way that there are professional associations for accountants and engineers and architects and surgeons and so on. It's not a barrier to entry. It's not a way of saying that you can't publish or you can't produce journalism if you're not a member. But if you are a member, then and you show that you, or that you're given membership, if you show that you understand professional ethics and standards, that you know and understand the law, and that you apply it routinely to your work, and that you therefore make yourself accountable to a complaints mechanism that our professional association runs. If you're a member, you can then badge your work online. You can stick a little kite mark next to your byline, so that the public can recognise content that's produced to a standard. They click on that little badge, that little kite mark, and it'll take you to a website that gives the ethics and standards of the organisation, the journalists that are members, and it points you to a complaints mechanism that you can go to if you think the journalism is failing to meet those standards.
Do you think
that's the way? That's the kind of model I think that we can and should be really seriously considering.
Do you think that people are well enough versed in understanding the sources of content to sort of be able to use a system like that or get the advantage of an identification system?
That's the whole point of having an identification system or a badging system, because that allows people to understand the differences between content that's produced according to a set of standards, and anyone can freely find out what those standards and ethics are, and work that may or may not be produced to the same standard.
Actually, now, Peter, on a slightly different subject, I was just thinking about the coming federal election in 2025, or we're not sure when it will be, but the way that the media reports on outright lies and misinformation that is mentioned by politicians, and the way that it would appear that sometimes the media is not investigating enough or interrogating some of the outrageous claims that are so obviously false. How in the, and this is increasing because it seems to be that politicians are willing to say anything. What do you think the media should be doing the media needs to do more to investigate these outrageous claims?
Yeah, it's a really, really difficult challenge, difficult problem for journalism, because if someone like Donald Trump, the president of the United States, says something, the fact that it comes out of his mouth makes it news. And you're almost duty bound to report it. I'm thinking of some of the rubbish that came out that Trump was saying during the pandemic, you know, saying things like chlorine and ultraviolet light could cure COVID. They were ridiculous, but the media had to report it because the president of the United States actually said it. You can do all the fact checking and analysis and holding those sort of lines to account and publish that in your story. But ultimately, you still, the fact that you're repeating what a lie that the president has stated means that you're giving oxygen to that lie. It's a very, very difficult challenge for journalists. But I think what we're seeing, if we think about, say, climate change, quite a few news organizations have decided that there is no value in broadcasting or publishing climate denialists. The science is in, there's a scientific consensus that balance no longer requires us to publish denialists just because they disagree with what the science is, because what you end up doing is giving false credence to that kind of view, and dealing with stories that cover the facts of climate change. I think that's also the way that we need to be going, ignoring outright lies, particularly whether from people who don't carry the same kind of authority as the President of the United States, and then challenging those lies whenever they get the opportunity.
It's interesting, Peter. Do you think that fact-checking works? Because, I mean, recently we've seen that the ABC RMIT fact-check unit has been disbanded. There was a big global movement over a number of years basically saying that fact-checking could be a solution to disinformation and misinformation circulating, particularly in digital environments. Do you think that actually works as an approach?
I think it helps. I'd have to see the end of fact-checking, but I don't think it's necessarily the solution. There's that old cliche that a lie is done 3 laps of the globe before the truth is out of the starting blocks. Fact-checking is helps, but it can never truly deal with misinformation, with outright lies. And particularly where people, I think, have a confirmation bias. We tend to believe things that support our own, or we tend to read things that support our own pre-existing views, and the algorithms encourage that kind of siloing. So, fact-checking is important. We need it. If we saw the end of fact-checking, then I think the system would be a hell of a lot worse off for it.
Yeah. Just one last one from me. Kim Williams has recently been appointed new chair of the ABC. I think it's a really interesting time for the ABC and for public broadcasters more generally because of the sort of media ecosystem we're working within. I think that those organisations have been remodelled or reshaped partly by the ways in which the media has changed. Do you have any thoughts on, Kim Williams as the chair of the ABC and where the public broadcaster should go in terms of its sort of contribution here?
I think, yeah, you're right. Kim Williams is an interesting choice, former News Corp executive. One of the things that I worry is that the ABC often seems to be trying to compete with commercial news organisations, when in fact I think it should be filling the gaps that that the commercial news organisations are leaving behind. We saw the drum disappear, and I think, you know, across the board, we're seeing news and current affairs, particularly in the commercial world, disappearing. Hasn't gone entirely, but it's increasingly under pressure. And so I think the ABC needs to step into that void. I'd be concerned that if Kim Williams decides to take the ABC in a more populist direction to try and hold on to its audiences just for the sake of being able to validate its existence alongside the commercial news organisations. We need to be very careful, of course, about jumping to conclusions about the direction that it's likely to take the organisation, but that would be my big concern.
I think that it has been a fantastic chat today, Peter. Thank you so much. I will be very keen to see what happens at the ABC, and I think we will all be interested in that.
And also what happens with Meta. I think it's going to be fascinating.
Absolutely. I think that I'm very curious to see what thinks that the conversation, for example, what Misha has planned for an alternative universe where we have the potential that Facebook will not be broadcasting covering any Australian news.
Now, just before we wrap up, we're just about to finish, but I've got a text message here which is saying, please ask Peter what he thinks of news podcasts taking over traditional news sources, as that's where young people consume their news now. What do you think of the role of podcasting in all this, Peter?
I think podcasting is great. And I think in saying that we need to ring fence or need to supply news organisations with a source of funding separates from commercial or political pressure, I also think, and this is one of the problems with the News Media Bargaining Code, was that it cemented in a lot of the traditional dinosaurs, media dinosaurs, that are finding it very difficult to adapt. And I think podcasting is a fantastic form of delivering news and information. We absolutely need to be encouraging it. It's starting to take off. I don't think journalism has fully yet understood how to take advantage of it. But absolutely, I think it's a great medium and at least one of the ways of the future for news.
Fantastic. Thank you, Peter, and thank you for giving us so much time this morning. It's terrific.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Peter. You're on Saturday Magazine with Misha and Fiona. We'll be back to wrap up in one second. Well, you're on Saturday Magazine, and that was a fantastic conversation, Misha, with Peter Grest.
Yeah, he's terrific.
He really is terrific, and thank you so much for bringing him onto the program. So we just touched a minute on the conversation. What alternative plans are you making for another a post-meta world?
Well, I mean, for us it's very simple. There's this media ecosystem online that's infected by misinformation and disinformation. The problem is nobody knows what they can trust. And what we do is we just work with academics. We commission from people who are actually experts in the subject matter that they're writing about, and they write without a vested interest, without a commercial interest, literally just to inform people, to explain things that are going on. So when the big thing happened with Meta last week, we get Peter Grest to write for us, and he writes a terrific piece because he's an expert in that area, in the role of public interest journalism. And we basically always work on that model. What we're trying to do really is recognise that online there's a community, the same way there's a community in the real world. And if you want that community to be better, you've got to model better behaviour. You've got to try to be a good citizen in that community yourself. So we work with people that know what they're talking about. We try to contribute positively, and we try to be a model of a source of trusted information, so people understand that there are some sources that you can trust that will go through that sort of journalistic process that Peter was talking about, where there's fact-checking, where there's codes of conduct, where there's all those rules, so that there's something that you can actually rely upon.
And as the executive producer of Saturday Magazine, I am a regular reader of The Conversation. We draw upon some of the fantastic experts of The Conversation, and Misha, we always value your contribution. So I can only recommend to all listeners to tune into The Conversation and keep up to date with the trusted news source. and stay listening to Saturday Magazine every Saturday.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a whole ecosystem of media organisations that are trying to do something different, which is serve communities in a constructive way. And I think Saturday Magazine is an example of that. You know, Joy FM is an example of that. And, you know, we see ourselves as part of that too.
So we're going to just do a quick rundown of our guests. Jackie Walter from Chill Out Festival. Josh Burns, MP for McNamara, always a delight to have in the program. May Aziz, who is from the spokesperson from Everyone's Home on the housing crisis. And, of course, Professor Peter Grester. Now, we do have coming up on Word for Word.
Bernadette Carroll.
And so that will be a tune-in. We want to thank Misha so much for coming on the program. Tune in next week. Stay on Joy and enjoy your weekend.
And stay cool.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.